Bearing two children in her 40s, she will, by the time she is 120, have only a distant memory of the years she spent raising them, a rather minor episode in her long life. It's hard to tell what kind of new parent-child relationship might develop under such circumstances. Or consider professional careers. Today we assume that you learn a profession in your teens and 20s, and then spend the rest of your life in that line of work. You obviously learn new things even in your 40s and 50s, but life is generally divided into a learning period followed by a working period. When you live to be 150, that won't do, especially in a world that is constantly being shaken by new technologies. People will have much longer careers, and will have to reinvent themselves again and again, even at the age of 90. At the same time, people will not retire at 65, and will not make way for the new generation with its novel ideas and aspirations. The physicist Max Planck famously said that science advances one funeral at a time. He meant that only when one generation passes away do new theories have a chance to root out old ones. This is true not only of science. Think for a moment about your own workplace. No matter whether you are a scholar, journalist, cook, or football player, how would you feel if your boss were 120, his ideas were formulated when Victoria was still queen, and he was likely to stay your boss for a couple of decades more? In the political sphere, the results might be even more sinister. Would you mind having Putin stick around for another 90 years? On second thoughts, if people lived to 150, then, in 2016, Stalin would still be ruling in Moscow, going strong at 138. Chairman Mao would be a middle-aged 123-year-old, and Princess Elizabeth would be sitting on her hands, waiting to inherit from the 121-year-old George VI. Her son Charles would not get his turn until 2076. Coming back to the realm of reality, it is far from certain whether Kurzweil's and de Grey's prophecies will come true by 2050 or 2100. My own view is that the hopes of eternal youth in the 21st century are premature, and whoever takes them too seriously is in for a bitter disappointment. It is not easy to live knowing that you are going to die, but it is even harder to believe in immortality and be proven wrong. Although average life expectancy has doubled over the last 100 years, it is unwarranted to extrapolate and conclude that we can double it again to 150 in the coming century. In 1900, global life expectancy was no higher than 40, because many people died young from malnutrition, infectious diseases, and violence. Yet those who escaped famine, plague, and war could live well into their 70s and 80s, which is the natural lifespan of Homo sapiens. Contrary to common notions, 70-year-olds weren't considered rare freaks of nature in previous centuries. Galileo Galilei died at 77, Isaac Newton at 84, and Michelangelo lived to the ripe age of 88, without any help from antibiotics, vaccinations, or organ transplants. Indeed, even chimpanzees in the jungle sometimes live into their 60s. In truth, so far modern medicine hasn't extended our natural lifespan by a single year. Its great achievement has been to save us from premature death, and allow us to enjoy the full measure of our years. Even if we now overcome cancer, diabetes, and the other major killers, it would mean only that almost everyone will get to live to 90, but it will not be enough to reach 150, let alone 500. For that, medicine will need to re-engineer the most fundamental structures and processes of the human body, and discover how to regenerate organs and tissues. It is by no means clear that we can do that by 2100. Nevertheless, every failed attempt to overcome death will get us a step closer to the target, and that will inspire greater hopes and encourage people to make even greater efforts. Though Google's Calico probably won't solve death in time to make Google co-founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page immortal, it will most probably make significant discoveries about cell biology, genetic medicines, and human health. The next generation of Googlers could therefore start their attack on death from new and better positions. The scientists who cry immortality are like the boy who cried wolf. Sooner or later, the wolf actually comes. Hence, even if we don't achieve immortality in our lifetime, the war against death is still likely to be the flagship project of the coming century. When you take into account our belief in the sanctity of human life, add the dynamics of the scientific establishment, and top it all with the needs of the capitalist economy, a relentless war against death seems to be inevitable. Our ideological commitment to human life will never allow us simply to accept human death. As long as people die of something, we will strive to overcome it. The scientific establishment and the capitalist economy will be more than happy to underwrite this struggle. Most scientists and bankers don't care what they are working on, provided it gives them an opportunity to make new discoveries and greater profits. Can anyone imagine a more exciting scientific challenge than outsmarting death, or a more promising market than the market of eternal youth? If you are over 40, close your eyes for a minute and try to remember the body you had at 25. Not only how it looked, but above all how it felt. If you could have that body back, how much would you be willing to pay for it? No doubt some people would be happy to forego the opportunity, but enough customers would pay whatever it takes, constituting a well-nigh infinite market. If all that is not enough, the fear of death ingrained in most humans will give the war against death an irresistible momentum. As long as people assumed that death is inevitable, they trained themselves from an early age to suppress the desire to live forever, or harnessed it in favor of substitute goals. People want to live forever, so they compose an immortal symphony. They strive for eternal glory in some war, or even sacrifice their lives so that their souls will enjoy everlasting bliss in paradise. A large part of our artistic creativity, our political commitment, and our religious piety is fueled by the fear of death. Woody Allen, who has made a fabulous career out of the fear of death, was once asked if he hoped to live on forever through the silver screen. Allen answered that, "I'd rather live on in my apartment." He went on to add that, "I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve it by not dying." Eternal glory, nationalist remembrance ceremonies, and dreams of paradise are very poor substitutes for what humans like Alan really want, not to die. Once people think, with or without good reason, that they have a serious chance of escaping death, the desire for life will refuse to go on pulling the rickety wagon of art, ideology, and religion, and will sweep forward like an avalanche. If you think that religious fanatics with burning eyes and flowing beards are ruthless, just wait and see what elderly retail moguls and aging Hollywood starlets will do when they think the elixir of life is within reach. If and when science makes significant progress in the war against death, the real battle will shift from the laboratories to the parliaments, courthouses, and streets. Once the scientific efforts are crowned with success, they will trigger bitter political conflicts. All the wars and conflicts of history might turn out to be but a pale prelude for the real struggle ahead of us, the struggle for eternal youth. The right to happiness. The second big project on the human agenda will probably be to find the key to happiness. Throughout history, numerous thinkers, prophets, and ordinary people defined happiness rather than life itself as the supreme good. In ancient Greece, the philosopher Epicurus explained that worshipping gods is a waste of time, that there is no existence after death, and that happiness is the sole purpose of life. Most people in ancient times rejected Epicureanism, but today it has become the default view. Skepticism about the afterlife drives humankind to seek not only immortality, but also earthly happiness. For who would like to live forever in eternal misery? For Epicurus, the pursuit of happiness was a personal quest. Modern thinkers, in contrast, tend to see it as a collective project. Without government planning, economic resources, and scientific research, Individuals will not get far in their quest for happiness. If your country is torn apart by war, if the economy is in crisis, and if health care is non-existent, you are likely to be miserable. At the end of the 18th century, the British philosopher Jeremy Bentham declared that the supreme good is the greatest happiness of the greatest number, and concluded that the sole worthy aim of the state, the market, and the scientific community is to increase global happiness. Politicians should make peace, business people should foster prosperity, and scholars should study nature, not for the greater glory of king, country, or God, but so that you and I could enjoy a happier life. During the 19th and 20th centuries, although many paid lip service to Bentham's vision, governments, corporations, and laboratories focused on more immediate and well-defined aims. Countries measured their success by the size of their territory, the increase in their population, and the growth of their GDP, not by the happiness of their citizens. Industrialized nations, such as Germany, France, and Japan, established gigantic systems of education, health, and welfare. Yet these systems were aimed to strengthen the nation rather than ensure individual well-being. Schools were founded to produce skillful and obedient citizens who would serve the nation loyally. At 18, youths needed to be not only patriotic, but also literate, so that they could read the Brigadier's Order of the Day and draw up tomorrow's battle plans. They had to know mathematics in order to calculate the shell's trajectory or crack the enemy's secret code. They needed a reasonable command of electrics, mechanics, and medicine in order to operate wireless sets, drive tanks, and take care of wounded comrades. When they left the army, they were expected to serve the nation as clerks, teachers, and engineers, building a modern economy and paying lots of taxes. The same went for the health system. At the end of the 19th century, countries such as France, Germany, and Japan began providing free health care for the masses. They financed vaccinations for infants, balanced diets for children, and physical education for teenagers. They drained festering swamps, exterminated mosquitoes, and built centralized sewage systems. The aim wasn't to make people happy, but to make the nation stronger. The country needed sturdy soldiers and workers, healthy women who would give birth to more soldiers and workers, and bureaucrats who came to the office punctually at 8 a.m. instead of lying sick at home. Even the welfare system was originally planned in the interest of the nation rather than of needy individuals. When Otto von Bismarck pioneered state pensions and social security in late 19th century Germany, his chief aim was to ensure the loyalty of the citizens rather than to increase their well-being. You fought for your country when you were 18 and paid your taxes when you were 40, because you counted on the state to take care of you when you were 70. In 1776, the founding fathers of the United States established the right to the pursuit of happiness as one of three unalienable human rights, alongside the right to life and the right to liberty. It's important to note, however, that the American Declaration of Independence guaranteed the right to the pursuit of happiness, not the right to happiness itself. Crucially, Thomas Jefferson did not make the state responsible for its citizens' happiness. Rather, he sought only to limit the power of the state. The idea was to reserve for individuals a private sphere of choice, free from state supervision. If I think I'll be happier marrying John rather than Mary, living in San Francisco rather than Salt Lake City, and working as a bartender rather than a dairy farmer, then it's my right to pursue happiness my way, and the state shouldn't intervene, even if I make the wrong choice. Yet over the last few decades, the tables have turned, and Bentham's vision has been taken far more seriously. People increasingly believe that the immense systems established more than a century ago to strengthen the nation should actually serve the happiness and well-being of individual citizens. We are not here to serve the state. It is here to serve us. The right to the pursuit of happiness, originally envisaged as a restraint on state power, has imperceptibly morphed into the right to happiness, as if human beings have a natural right to be happy, and anything which makes us dissatisfied is a violation of our basic human rights, so the state should do something about it. In the 20th century, per capita GDP was perhaps the supreme yardstick for evaluating national success. From this perspective, Singapore, each of whose citizens produces on average $56,000 worth of goods and services a year, is a more successful country than Costa Rica, whose citizens produce only $14,000 a year. But nowadays, thinkers, politicians, and even economists are calling to supplement or even replace GDP with GDH, gross domestic happiness. After all, what do people want? They don't want to produce. They want to be happy. Production is important because it provides the material basis for happiness. But it is only the means, not the end. In one survey after another, Costa Ricans report far higher levels of life satisfaction than Singaporeans. Would you rather be a highly productive but dissatisfied Singaporean, or a less productive but satisfied Costa Rican? This kind of logic might drive humankind to make happiness its second main goal for the 21st century. At first glance, this might seem a relatively easy project. If famine, plague, and war are disappearing, if humankind experiences unprecedented peace and prosperity, and if life expectancy increases dramatically, surely all this will make humans happy, right? Wrong. When Epicurus defined happiness as the supreme good, he warned his disciples that it is hard work to be happy. Material achievements alone will not satisfy us for long. Indeed, the blind pursuit of money, fame, and pleasure will only make us miserable. Epicurus recommended, for example, to eat and drink in moderation, and to curb one's sexual appetites. In the long run, a deep friendship will make us more content than a frenzied orgy. Epicurus outlined an entire ethic of do's and don'ts to guide people along the treacherous path to happiness. Epicurus was apparently onto something. Being happy doesn't come easy. Despite our unprecedented achievements in the last few decades, it is far from obvious that contemporary people are significantly more satisfied than their ancestors in bygone years. Indeed, it is an ominous sign that despite higher prosperity, comfort, and security, the rate of suicide in the developed world is also much higher than in traditional societies. In Peru, Guatemala, the Philippines, and Albania, developing countries suffering from poverty and political instability, about one person in 100,000 commits suicide each year. In rich and peaceful countries, such as Switzerland, France, Japan, and New Zealand, 25 people per 100,000 take their own lives annually. In 1985, most South Koreans were poor, uneducated, and tradition-bound, living under an authoritarian dictatorship. Today, South Korea is a leading economic power, its citizens are among the best educated in the world, and it enjoys a stable and comparatively liberal democratic regime. Yet whereas in 1985, about 9 South Koreans per 100,000 killed themselves, today the annual rate of suicide has more than tripled to 30 per 100,000. There are, of course, opposite and far more encouraging trends. Thus, the drastic decrease in child mortality has surely brought an increase in human happiness and partially compensated people for the stress of modern life. Still, even if we are somewhat happier than our ancestors, the increase in our well-being is far less than we might have expected. In the Stone Age, the average human had at his or her disposal about 4,000 calories of energy per day. This included not only food, but also the energy invested in preparing tools, clothing, art, and campfires. Today, Americans use on average 228,000 calories of energy per person per day, to feed not only their stomachs, but also their cars, computers, refrigerators, and televisions. The average American thus uses 60 times more energy than the average Stone Age hunter-gatherer. Is the average American 60 times happier? We may well be skeptical about such rosy views. And even if we have overcome many of yesterday's miseries, attaining positive happiness may be far more difficult than abolishing downright suffering. It took just a piece of bread to make a starving medieval peasant joyful. How do you bring joy to a bored, overpaid, and overweight engineer? The second half of the 20th century was a golden age for the USA. Victory in the Second World War, followed by an even more decisive victory in the Cold War, turned it into the leading global superpower. Between 1950 and 2000, American GDP grew from $2 trillion to $12 trillion. Real per capita income doubled. The newly invented contraceptive pill made sex freer than ever. Women, gays, African Americans, and other minorities finally got a bigger slice of the American pie. A flood of cheap cars, refrigerators, air conditioners, vacuum cleaners, dishwashers, laundry machines, telephones, televisions, and computers changed daily life almost beyond recognition. Yet studies have shown that American subjective well-being levels in the 1990s remained roughly the same as they were in the 1950s. In Japan, average real income rose by a factor of 5 between 1958 and 1987, in one of the fastest economic booms of history. This avalanche of wealth, coupled with myriad positive and negative changes in Japanese lifestyles and social relations, had surprisingly little impact on Japanese subjective well-being levels. The Japanese in the 1990s were as satisfied, or dissatisfied, as they were in the 1950s. It appears that our happiness bangs against some mysterious glass ceiling that does not allow it to grow despite all our unprecedented accomplishments. Even if we provide free food for everybody, cure all diseases, and ensure world peace, it won't necessarily shatter that glass ceiling. Achieving real happiness is not going to be much easier than overcoming old age and death. The glass ceiling of happiness is held in place by two stout pillars, one psychological, the other biological. On the psychological level, happiness depends on expectations rather than objective conditions. We don't become satisfied by leading a peaceful and prosperous existence. Rather, we become satisfied when reality matches our expectations. The bad news is that as conditions improve, expectations balloon. Dramatic improvements in conditions, as humankind has experienced in recent decades, translate into greater expectations rather than greater contentment. If we don't do something about this, our future achievements too might leave us as dissatisfied as ever. On the biological level, both our expectations and our happiness are determined by our biochemistry rather than by our economic, social, or political situation. According to Epicurus, we are happy when we feel pleasant sensations and are free from unpleasant ones. Jeremy Bentham similarly maintained that nature gave dominion over man to two masters, pleasure and pain, and they alone determine everything we do, say, and think. Bentham's successor, John Stuart Mill, explained that happiness is nothing but pleasure and freedom from pain, and that beyond pleasure and pain, there is no good and no evil. Anyone who tries to deduce good and evil from something else, such as the word of God or the national interest, is fooling you, and perhaps fooling himself too. In the days of Epicurus, such talk was blasphemous. In the days of Bentham and Mill, it was radical subversion. But in the early 21st century, this is scientific orthodoxy. According to the life sciences, happiness and suffering are nothing but different balances of bodily sensations. We never react to events in the outside world, but only to sensations in our own bodies. Nobody suffers because she lost her job, because she got divorced, or because the government went to war. The only thing that makes people miserable is unpleasant sensations in their own bodies. Losing one's job can certainly trigger depression, but depression itself is a kind of unpleasant bodily sensation. A thousand things may make us angry, but anger is never an abstraction. It is always felt as a sensation of heat and tension in the body, which is what makes anger so infuriating. Not for nothing do we say that we burn with anger. Conversely, science says that nobody is ever made happy by getting a promotion, winning the lottery, or even finding true love. People are made happy by one thing and one thing only, pleasant sensations in their bodies. Imagine that you are Mario Götze, the attacking midfielder of the German football team in the 2014 World Cup final against Argentina. 113 minutes have already elapsed, without a goal being scored. Only 7 minutes remain before the dreaded penalty shootout. Some 75,000 excited fans fill the Macarena Stadium in Rio, with countless millions anxiously watching all over the world. You are a few meters from the Argentinian goal when André Schürrle sends a magnificent pass in your direction. You stop the ball with your chest. It drops down towards your leg, you give it a kick in mid-air, and you see it fly past the Argentinian goalkeeper and bury itself deep inside the net. Goal! The stadium erupts like a volcano. Tens of thousands of people roar like mad. Your teammates are racing to hug and kiss you. Millions of people back home in Berlin and Munich collapse in tears before the television screen. You are ecstatic. But not because of the ball in the Argentinian net, or the celebrations going on in crammed Bavarian beer gardens. You are actually reacting to the storm of sensations within you. Chills run up and down your spine, waves of electricity wash over your body, and it feels as if you are dissolving into millions of exploding energy balls. You don't have to score the winning goal in the World Cup final to feel such sensations. If you receive an unexpected promotion at work and start jumping for joy, you are reacting to the same kind of sensations. The deeper parts of your mind know nothing about football or about jobs. They know only sensations. If you get a promotion but for some reason don't feel any pleasant sensations, you will not feel satisfied. The opposite is also true. If you have just been fired or lost a decisive football match, but you are experiencing very pleasant sensations, perhaps because you popped some pill, you might still feel on top of the world. The bad news is that pleasant sensations quickly subside and sooner or later turn into unpleasant ones. Even scoring the winning goal in the World Cup final doesn't guarantee lifelong bliss. In fact, it might all be downhill from there. Similarly, if last year I received an unexpected promotion at work, I might still be occupying that new position, but the very pleasant sensations I experienced on hearing the news disappeared within hours. If I want to feel those wonderful sensations again, I must get another promotion, and another. And if I don't get a promotion, I might end up far more bitter and angry than if I had remained a humble pawn. This is all the fault of evolution. For countless generations, our biochemical system adapted to increasing our chances of survival and reproduction, not our happiness. The biochemical system rewards actions conducive to survival and reproduction with pleasant sensations. But these are only an ephemeral sales gimmick. We struggle to get food and mates in order to avoid unpleasant sensations of hunger, and to enjoy pleasing tastes and blissful orgasms. But nice tastes and blissful orgasms don't last very long, and if we want to feel them again, we have to go out looking for more food and mates. What might have happened if a rare mutation had created a squirrel who, after eating a single nut, enjoys an everlasting sensation of bliss? Technically, this could actually be done by rewiring the squirrel's brain. Who knows, perhaps it really happened to some lucky squirrel millions of years ago. But if so, that squirrel enjoyed an extremely happy and extremely short life, and that was the end of the rare mutation. For the blissful squirrel would not have bothered to look for more nuts, let alone mates. The rival squirrels, who felt hungry again 5 minutes after eating a nut, had much better chances of surviving and passing their genes to the next generation. For exactly the same reason, the nuts we humans seek to gather, lucrative jobs, big houses, good-looking partners, seldom satisfy us for long. Some may say that this is not so bad, because it isn't the goal that makes us happy, it's the journey. Climbing Mount Everest is more satisfying than standing at the top. Flirting and foreplay are more exciting than having an orgasm. and conducting groundbreaking lab experiments is more interesting than receiving praise and prizes. Yet this hardly changes the picture. It just indicates that evolution controls us with a broad range of pleasures. Sometimes it seduces us with sensations of bliss and tranquility, while on other occasions it goads us forward with thrilling sensations of elation and excitement. When an animal is looking for something that increases its chances of survival and reproduction, for example, food, partners, or social status, the brain produces sensations of alertness and excitement, which drive the animal to make even greater efforts because they are so very agreeable. In a famous experiment, scientists connected electrodes to the brains of several rats, enabling the animals to create sensations of excitement simply by pressing a pedal. When the rats were given a choice between tasty food and pressing the pedal, they preferred the pedal, much like kids preferring to play video games rather than come down to dinner. The rats pressed the pedal again and again until they collapsed from hunger and exhaustion. Humans, too, may prefer the excitement of the race to resting on the laurels of success. Yet, what makes the race so attractive is the exhilarating sensations that go along with it. Nobody would have wanted to climb mountains, play video games, or go on blind dates if such activities were accompanied solely by unpleasant sensations of stress, despair, or boredom. Alas, the exciting sensations of the race are as transient as the blissful sensations of victory. The Don Juan enjoying the thrill of a one-night stand, the businessman enjoying biting his fingernails watching the Dow Jones rise and fall, and the gamer enjoying killing monsters on the computer screen, will find no satisfaction remembering yesterday's adventures. Like the rats pressing the pedal again and again, the Don Juans, business tycoons, and gamers need a new kick every day. Worse still, here too expectations adapt to conditions, and yesterday's challenges all too quickly become today's tedium. Perhaps the key to happiness is neither the race nor the gold medal, but rather combining the right doses of excitement and tranquility. But most of us tend to jump all the way from stress to boredom and back, remaining as discontented with one as with the other. If science is right, and our happiness is determined by our biochemical system, then the only way to ensure lasting contentment is by rigging this system. Forget economic growth, social reforms, and political revolutions. In order to raise global happiness levels, we need to manipulate human biochemistry. And this is exactly what we have begun doing over the last few decades. 50 years ago, psychiatric drugs carried a severe stigma. Today, that stigma has been broken. For better or worse, a growing percentage of the population is taking psychiatric medicines on a regular basis, not only to cure debilitating mental illnesses, but also to face more mundane depressions and the occasional blues. For example, increasing numbers of schoolchildren take stimulants such as Ritalin. In 2011, 3.5 million American children were taking medications for ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. In the UK, the number rose from 92,000 in 1997 to 786,000 in 2012. The original aim had been to treat attention disorders, but today, completely healthy kids take such medications to improve their performance and live up to the growing expectations of teachers and parents. Many object to this development and argue that the problem lies with the education system rather than with the children. If pupils suffer from attention disorders, stress, and low grades, perhaps we ought to blame outdated teaching methods, overcrowded classrooms, and an unnaturally fast tempo of life. Maybe we should modify the schools rather than the kids. It is interesting to see how the arguments have evolved. People have been quarreling about education methods for thousands of years. Whether in ancient China or Victorian Britain, everybody had his or her pet method and vehemently opposed all alternatives. Yet hitherto, everybody still agreed on one thing. In order to improve education, we need to change the schools. Today, for the first time in history, At least some people think it would be more efficient to change the pupils' biochemistry. Armies are heading the same way. 12% of American soldiers in Iraq and 17% of American soldiers in Afghanistan took either sleeping pills or antidepressants to help them deal with the pressure and distress of war. Fear, depression, and trauma are not caused by shells, booby traps, or car bombs. They are caused by hormones, neurotransmitters, and neural networks. Two soldiers may find themselves shoulder to shoulder in the same ambush. One will freeze in terror, lose his wits, and suffer from nightmares for years after the event. The other will charge forward courageously and win a medal. The difference is in the soldier's biochemistry, and if we find ways to control it, we will, at one stroke, produce both happier soldiers and more efficient armies. The biochemical pursuit of happiness is also the number one cause of crime in the world. In 2009, half of the inmates in U.S. federal prisons got there because of drugs. 38% of Italian prisoners were convicted of drug-related offenses. 55% of inmates in the U.K. reported that they committed their crimes in connection with either consuming or trading drugs. A 2001 report found that 62% of Australian convicts were under the influence of drugs when committing the crime for which they were incarcerated. People drink alcohol to forget. They smoke pot to feel peaceful. They take cocaine and methamphetamines to be sharp and confident. Whereas ecstasy provides ecstatic sensations, and LSD sends you to meet Lucy in the sky with diamonds. What some people hope to get by studying, working, or raising a family, others try to obtain far more easily through the right dosage of molecules. This is an existential threat to the social and economic order, which is why countries wage a stubborn, bloody, and hopeless war on biochemical crime. The state hopes to regulate the biochemical pursuit of happiness, separating bad manipulations from good ones. The principle is clear. Biochemical manipulations that strengthen political stability, social order, and economic growth are allowed and even encouraged. For example, those that calm hyperactive kids in school or drive anxious soldiers forward into battle. Manipulations that threaten stability and growth are banned. But each year new drugs are born in the research labs of universities, pharmaceutical companies, and criminal organizations. And the needs of the state and the market also keep changing. As the biochemical pursuit of happiness accelerates, so it will reshape politics, society, and economics, and it will become ever harder to bring it under control. And drugs are just the beginning. In research labs, experts are already working on more sophisticated ways of manipulating human biochemistry, such as sending direct electrical stimuli to appropriate spots in the brain, or genetically engineering the blueprints of our bodies. No matter the exact method, gaining happiness through biological manipulation won't be easy, for it requires altering the fundamental patterns of life. But then, it wasn't easy to overcome famine, plague, and war either. It is far from certain that humankind should invest so much effort in the biochemical pursuit of happiness. Some would argue that happiness simply isn't important enough, and that it is misguided to regard individual satisfaction as the highest aim of human society. Others may agree that happiness is indeed the supreme good, yet would take issue with the biological definition of happiness as the experience of pleasant sensations. Some 2,300 years ago, Epicurus warned his disciples that immoderate pursuit of pleasure is likely to make them miserable rather than happy. A couple of centuries earlier, Buddha had made an even more radical claim, teaching that the pursuit of pleasant sensations is in fact the very root of suffering. Such sensations are just ephemeral and meaningless vibrations. Even when we experience them, we don't react to them with contentment. Rather, we just crave for more. Hence, no matter how many blissful or exciting sensations I may experience, they will never satisfy me. If I identify happiness with fleeting, pleasant sensations, and crave to experience more and more of them, I have no choice but to pursue them constantly. When I finally get them, they quickly disappear, and because the mere memory of past pleasures will not satisfy me, I have to start all over again. Even if I continue this pursuit for decades, it will never bring me any lasting achievement. On the contrary, the more I crave these pleasant sensations, the more stressed and dissatisfied I will become. To attain real happiness, humans need to slow down the pursuit of pleasant sensations, not accelerate it. This Buddhist view of happiness has a lot in common with the biochemical view. Both agree that pleasant sensations disappear as fast as they arise, and that as long as people crave pleasant sensations without actually experiencing them, they remain dissatisfied. However, this problem has two very different solutions. The biochemical solution is to develop products and treatments that will provide humans with an unending stream of pleasant sensations, so we will never be without them. The Buddha's suggestion was to reduce our craving for pleasant sensations and not allow them to control our lives. According to Buddha, we can train our minds to observe carefully how all sensations constantly arise and pass. When the mind learns to see our sensations for what they are, ephemeral and meaningless vibrations, we lose interest in pursuing them. For what is the point of running after something that disappears as fast as it arises? At present, humankind has far greater interest in the biochemical solution. No matter what monks in their Himalayan caves or philosophers in their ivory towers say, for the capitalist juggernaut, happiness is pleasure. Period. With each passing year, our tolerance for unpleasant sensations decreases, and our craving for pleasant sensations increases. Both scientific research and economic activity are geared to that end, each year producing better painkillers, new ice cream flavors, more comfortable mattresses, and more addictive games for our smartphones, so that we will not suffer a single boring moment while waiting for the bus. All this is hardly enough, of course. Since Homo sapiens was not adapted by evolution to experience constant pleasure, if that is what humankind nevertheless wants, ice cream and smartphone games will not do. It will be necessary to change our biochemistry and re-engineer our bodies and minds. So we are working on that. You may debate whether it is good or bad, but it seems that the second great project of the 21st century, to ensure global happiness, will involve re-engineering Homo sapiens so that it can enjoy everlasting pleasure. The gods of planet Earth. In seeking bliss and immortality, humans are in fact trying to upgrade themselves into gods. Not just because these are divine qualities, but because in order to overcome old age and misery, humans will first have to acquire godlike control of their own biological substratum. If we ever have the power to engineer death and pain out of our system, that same power will probably be sufficient to engineer our system in almost any manner we like, and manipulate our organs, emotions, and intelligence in myriad ways. You could buy for yourself the strength of Hercules, the sensuality of Aphrodite, the wisdom of Athena, or the madness of Dionysus, if that is what you are into. Up till now, increasing human power relied mainly on upgrading our external tools. In the future, it may rely more on upgrading the human body and mind, or on merging directly with our tools. The upgrading of humans into gods may follow any of three paths: biological engineering, cyborg engineering, and the engineering of non-organic beings. Biological engineering starts with the insight that we are far from realizing the full potential of organic bodies. For 4 billion years, natural selection has been tweaking and tinkering with these bodies, so that we have gone from amoeba to reptiles to mammals to sapiens. Yet there is no reason to think that sapiens is the last station. Relatively small changes in genes, hormones, and neurons were enough to transform Homo erectus, who could produce nothing more impressive than flint knives, into Homo sapiens, who produces spaceships and computers. Who knows what might be the outcome of a few more changes to our DNA, hormonal system, or brain structure? Bioengineering is not going to wait patiently for natural selection to work its magic. Instead, bioengineers will take the old sapien's body and intentionally rewrite its genetic code, rewire its brain circuits, alter its biochemical balance, and even grow entirely new limbs. They will thereby create new godlings, who might be as different from us sapiens as we are different from Homo erectus. Cyborg engineering will go a step further, merging the organic body with non-organic devices such as bionic hands, artificial eyes, or millions of nanorobots that will navigate our bloodstream, diagnose problems, and repair damage. Such a cyborg could enjoy abilities far beyond those of any organic body. For example, all parts of an organic body must be in direct contact with one another in order to function. If an elephant's brain is in India, its eyes and ears in China, and its feet in Australia, then this elephant is most probably dead, and even if it is in some mysterious sense alive, it cannot see, hear, or walk. A cyborg, in contrast, could exist in numerous places at the same time. A cyborg doctor could perform emergency surgeries in Tokyo, in Chicago, and in a space station on Mars, without ever leaving her Stockholm office. She will need only a fast internet connection, and a few pairs of bionic eyes and hands. On second thoughts, why pairs? Why not quartets? Indeed, even those are actually superfluous. Why should a cyborg doctor hold a surgeon's scalpel by hand, when she could connect her mind directly to the instrument? This may sound like science fiction, but it's already a reality. Monkeys have recently learned to control bionic hands and feet disconnected from their bodies through electrodes implanted in their brains. Paralyzed patients are able to move bionic limbs or operate computers by the power of thought alone. If you wish, you can already remote control electric devices in your house using an electric mind-reading helmet. The helmet requires no brain implants. It functions by reading the electric signals passing through your scalp. If you want to turn on the light in the kitchen, you just wear the helmet, imagine some pre-programmed mental sign. For example, imagine your right hand moving, and the switch turns on. You can buy such helmets online for a mere $400. In early 2015, several hundred workers in the Epicenter high-tech hub in Stockholm had microchips implanted into their hands. The chips are about the size of a grain of rice and store personalized security information that enables workers to open doors and operate photocopiers with a wave of their hand. Soon, they hope to make payments in the same way. One of the people behind the initiative, Hannes Sjöblad, explained that "We already interact with technology all the time. Today it's a bit messy. We need PIN codes and passwords. Wouldn't it be easy to just touch with your hand?" Yet even cyborg engineering is relatively conservative, inasmuch as it assumes that organic brains will go on being the command and control centers of life. A bolder approach dispenses with organic parts altogether, and hopes to engineer completely non-organic beings. Neural networks will be replaced by intelligent software, which could surf both the virtual and non-virtual worlds, free from the limitations of organic chemistry. After 4 billion years of wandering inside the kingdom of organic compounds, life will break out into the vastness of the inorganic realm, and will take shapes that we cannot envision even in our wildest dreams. After all, our wildest dreams are still the product of organic chemistry. We don't know where these paths might lead us, nor what our godlike descendants will look like. Foretelling the future was never easy, and revolutionary biotechnologies make it even harder. For as difficult as it is to predict the impact of new technologies in fields like transportation, communication, and energy, technologies for upgrading humans pose a completely different kind of challenge. Since they can be used to transform human minds and desires, people possessing present-day minds and desires, by definition, cannot fathom their implications. For thousands of years, history was full of technological, economic, social, and political upheavals. Yet one thing remained constant: humanity itself. Our tools and institutions are very different from those of biblical times, but the deep structures of the human mind remain the same. This is why we can still find ourselves between the pages of the Bible, in the writings of Confucius, or within the tragedies of Sophocles and Euripides. These classics were created by humans just like us, hence we feel that they talk about us. In modern theatre productions, Oedipus, Hamlet, and Othello may wear jeans and t-shirts and have Facebook accounts, but their emotional conflicts are the same as in the original play. However, once technology enables us to re-engineer human minds, Homo sapiens will disappear, human history will come to an end, and a completely new kind of process will begin, which people like you and me cannot comprehend. Many scholars try to predict how the world will look in the year 2100 or 2200. This is a waste of time. Any worthwhile prediction must take into account the ability to re-engineer human minds, and this is impossible. There are many wise answers to the question, what would people with minds like ours do with biotechnology? Yet there are no good answers to the question, what would beings with a different kind of mind do with biotechnology? All we can say is that people similar to us are likely to use biotechnology to re-engineer their own minds, and our present-day minds cannot grasp what might happen next. Though the details are therefore obscure, we can nevertheless be sure about the general direction of history. In the 21st century, the third big project of humankind will be to acquire for us divine powers of creation and destruction, and upgrade Homo sapiens into Homo Deus. This third project obviously subsumes the first two projects, and is fueled by them. We want the ability to re-engineer our bodies and minds in order, above all, to escape old age, death, and misery. But, once we have it, who knows what else we might do with such ability? So we may well think of the new human agenda as consisting really of only one project, with many branches: attaining divinity. If this sounds unscientific or downright eccentric, it is because people often misunderstand the meaning of divinity. Divinity isn't a vague metaphysical quality, and it isn't the same as omnipotence. When speaking of upgrading humans into gods, think more in terms of Greek gods or Hindu devas, rather than the omnipotent biblical Sky Father. Our descendants would still have their foibles, kinks, and limitations, just as Zeus and Indra had theirs. But they could love, hate, create, and destroy on a much grander scale than us. Throughout history, most gods were believed to enjoy not omnipotence, but rather specific super-abilities, such as the ability to design and create living beings, to transform their own bodies, to control the environment and the weather, to read minds and to communicate at a distance, to travel at very high speeds, and, of course, to escape death and live indefinitely. Humans are in the business of acquiring all these abilities, and then some. Certain traditional abilities that were considered divine for many millennia have today become so commonplace that we hardly think about them. The average person now moves and communicates across distances much more easily than the Greek, Hindu, or African gods of old. For example, the Igbo people of Nigeria believe that the creator god Chukwu initially wanted to make people immortal. He sent a dog to tell humans that when someone dies, they should sprinkle ashes on the corpse, and the body will come back to life. Unfortunately, the dog was tired, and he dallied on the way. The impatient Chukwu then sent a sheep, telling her to make haste with this important message. Alas, when the breathless sheep reached her destination, she garbled the instructions, and told the humans to bury their dead, thus making death permanent. This is why, to this day, we humans must die. If only Chukwu had a Twitter account, instead of relying on laggard dogs and dim-witted sheep to deliver his messages. In ancient agricultural societies, most religions revolved not around metaphysical questions and the afterlife, but around the very mundane issue of increasing agricultural output. Thus, the Old Testament God never promises any rewards or punishments after death. He instead tells the people of Israel that If you carefully observe the commands that I'm giving you, then I will send rain on the land in its season, and you'll gather grain, wine, and oil. I will provide grass in the fields for your livestock, and you'll eat and be satisfied. Be careful, otherwise your hearts will deceive you, and you will turn away to serve other gods and worship them. The wrath of God will burn against you, so that he will restrain the heavens, and it won't rain. The ground won't yield its produce, and you'll be swiftly destroyed from the good land that the Lord is about to give you. Deuteronomy chapter 11, verses 13 through 17. Scientists today can do much better than the Old Testament God. Thanks to artificial fertilizers, industrial insecticides, and genetically modified crops, agricultural production nowadays outstrips the highest expectations ancient farmers had of their gods. And the parched state of Israel no longer fears that some angry deity will restrain the heavens and stop all rain, for the Israelis have recently built a huge desalination plant on the shores of the Mediterranean, so they can now get all their drinking water from the sea. So far, we have competed with the gods of old by creating better and better tools. In the not-too-distant future, we might create superhumans who will outstrip the ancient gods, not in their tools, but in their bodily and mental faculties. If and when we get there, however, divinity will become as mundane as cyberspace, a wonder of wonders that we just take for granted. We can be quite certain that humans will make a bid for divinity, because humans have many reasons to desire such an upgrade, and many ways to achieve it. Even if one promising path turns out to be a dead end, alternative routes will remain open. For example, we may discover that the human genome is far too complicated for serious manipulation, but this will not prevent the development of brain-computer interfaces, nano-robots, or artificial intelligence. No need to panic, though. At least, not immediately. Upgrading sapiens will be a gradual historical process, rather than a Hollywood apocalypse. Homo sapiens is not going to be exterminated by a robot revolt. Rather, Homo sapiens is likely to upgrade itself step by step, merging with robots and computers in the process, until our descendants will look back and realize that they are no longer the kind of animal that wrote the Bible, built the Great Wall of China, and laughed at Charlie Chaplin's antics. This will not happen in a day or a year. Indeed, it is already happening right now, through innumerable mundane actions. Every day, millions of people decide to grant their smartphone a bit more control over their lives, or try a new and more effective antidepressant drug. In pursuit of health, happiness, and power, humans will gradually change first one of their features, and then another, and another, until they will no longer be human. Can someone please hit the brakes? Calm explanations aside, many people panic when they hear of such possibilities. They are happy to follow the advice of their smartphones, or to take whatever drug the doctor prescribes, but when they hear of upgraded superhumans, they say, "I hope I will be dead before that happens." A friend once told me that what she fears most about growing old is becoming irrelevant, turning into a nostalgic old woman who cannot understand the world around her, or contribute much to it. This is what we fear collectively as a species when we hear of superhumans. We sense that in such a world, our identity, our dreams, and even our fears will be irrelevant, and we will have nothing more to contribute. Whatever you are today, be it a devout Hindu cricket player or an aspiring lesbian journalist, in an upgraded world you will feel like a Neanderthal hunter in Wall Street. You won't belong. The Neanderthals didn't have to worry about the Nasdaq, since they were shielded from it by tens of thousands of years. Nowadays, however, our world of meaning might collapse within decades. You cannot count on death to save you from becoming completely irrelevant. Even if gods don't walk our streets by 2100, the attempt to upgrade Homo sapiens is likely to change the world beyond recognition in this century. Scientific research and technological developments are moving at a far faster rate than most of us can grasp. If you speak with the experts, Many of them will tell you that we are still very far away from genetically engineered babies or human-level artificial intelligence. But most experts think on a timescale of academic grants and college jobs. Hence, very far away may mean 20 years.